to the KTEP Book Club on Perspectives. I'm your host, Louis Sines. And joining us on Perspectives today is Dr. John M. Logsdon. Dr. Logsdon is a world-recognized historian and analyst of space issues. He had an award-winning book, John F. Kennedy and the Race to the Moon, 2010. He received a wide range of positive reviews, and Dr. Logsdon is a professor emeritus at the George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs and was the founder of the longtime director of George Washington's Space Policy Institute. He's joining us today on the heels of his latest book, Richard Nixon and the American Space Program, After Apollo. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
And with us is Norma Martinez. Our engineer producer is here to co-host Dr. Logsdon's interview. And Dr. Logsdon, if you don't mind, we're going to call you John. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay. First of all, John, it's been a while since, you know, we've had anything to do with space. And it seems like with the space shuttles, after a while, people were just like, well, another one went up. Oh, really? I didn't know that. Whereas before, people would follow the space program very closely. So from your perspective, because you wrote a book also about John Kennedy and the race to the moon, what has happened?
Well, we're not doing things that are publicly exciting. I mean, the shuttle program was supposed to become routine, so it became a victim of its own success. I mean, think if it had achieved its early goals of 24 or 40 or even 60 launches a year, it would have become even more routine, even at 5 launches a year. I mean, a launch was a launch, so that there wasn't a lot of exciting content unless a particular mission was spectacular.
Now, as you mentioned in your book, and if people remember that speech that John Kennedy gave at, I guess it was Rice University?
Well, there's some confusion. The people in Texas would like to think that President Kennedy announced his decision to go to the moon at Rice, but actually he made the proposal before a joint session of Congress on May the 25th, 1961. The Rice speech was in September of 62, and it was his public high-flying rhetoric justification of why we were doing this, because it was hard, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. But that was not the announcement of the Apollo program.
So in those words that you just quoted the president saying, not because it is easy, but because it is hard, were we a different type of nation then? We were willing to take on sacrifices, willing to work for things and wanted things the hard way because we were Americans?
Well, I think there was a little bit of that kind of American exceptionalism in Kennedy's thought as he challenged the country and the Congress to decide whether to support Apollo or not. When he made the proposal in May of 61, he said, this is going to be hard. It's going to be expensive. We all are going to have to bear the burden. I mean, it was part of Kennedy's message, after all, was the country had to sacrifice in order to maintain its position in the world.
And John, I remember hearing a few years ago, and I don't think this came as much of a surprise to too many people, was that when John F. Kennedy did make that speech, he really wasn't making the speech in order to advance the U.S. space program. He was really just trying to get ahead of the Russians.
Clearly, that was his motivation at the start of Apollo. He wrote on week after the Gagarin flight in April 61, he asked his advisors to find me a space program which promises dramatic results in which we could win. So winning was very important. I mean, Kennedy was a very competitive personality and I think chose the lunar landing program because it gave the best odds of doing something spectacular before the Soviet Union.
And another thing, going back to what Louis was saying earlier about how the shuttle missions became routine, but the earlier missions, Apollo, Gemini, et cetera, were not. But I think that they did. Of course, the very first flight that landed us on the moon, the Apollo 1 fire that killed 3 astronauts, those are events that sort of stayed in people's imaginations. But after Apollo 11, obviously nobody remembers Apollo 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 8, because it was the first to circle the moon. But after Apollo 11, moon landings, I guess, sort of became routine to people. And I don't even think too many people remember that Neil Armstrong himself was very famous for saving his own life in a Gemini spacecraft.
Right.
Those missions just sort of fall into the background. But the only ones we remember are Apollo 11, Apollo 13, the other missions, Apollo 17, because it was the last to land on the moon. But nobody really remembers the others because they really were rather routine.
Well, they looked routine. they weren't easy. I mean, each of those were very risky undertakings. But yes, by the time Apollo 13 lifted off, the networks were no longer covering the missions with the same kind of intensity that they had covered 11 and 12. It's only when Lovell radioed back, "We've got a problem," that the networks came back on. Apollo 15, the White House announced that Nixon was watching it very carefully. In fact, he slept through the launching. So, I mean, the American public has a short attention span, for better or for worse. So if you do basically the same thing over and over, it's not going to maintain attention.
Because you have watched these programs from the insider's look, you have a lot of insight to this. And as you mentioned, you know, the press will tell us one thing and this is what really happened. But sometimes the press, through the PR person, the person who spins, wants us to have a certain picture. And I think in another book, The Decision to Go to the Moon, the Apollo Project and the National Interest, you write about the fact that this speech to go to the moon was very timely because, as Norma mentioned, the Russian situation and also the Bay of Pigs, and this administration was looking for something to give America the shot in the arm that they needed.
Yeah, I looked very closely at the impact of the Bay of Pigs. I mean, for people who don't have the timeline in their head, Gagarin was April the 12th. Bay of Pigs was April 17th through 19th. The Kennedy memo saying, "Find me a program which we could win," is April 20th. So how much did the Bay of Pigs influence Kennedy's decision? I come to the conclusion, after carefully looking at the documentary record, that it reinforced the decision. It wasn't the reason that he made the decision. He had brought his advisors together 2 days after the Gagarin flight, saying, "Find me something. There's nothing more important." And Ted Sorensen, his top aide, that day said, "Well, we're going to the moon." So that was before the Bay of Pigs. I think it reinforced his conviction that there had to be something positive, but was not the direct cause.
And after that decision was finally made, of course, was the tragic assassination of President Kennedy. So from your perspective and the insiders, what took place there? What did this do to President Johnson's administration and the rest of NASA and the people in Washington?
Well, by 1963, there were growing doubts about the wisdom of the Apollo commitment. We tend to forget that in hindsight. And the thing that we most forget is that Kennedy went to before the United Nations in September of 1963, 2 months before he was assassinated, and said, "Why shouldn't the U.S. and the Soviet Union do it together rather than race?" With his assassination, I think that possibility disappeared, and Apollo became a monument to a fallen young president. But he was having second thoughts in the last months of his life.
And after John Kennedy was assassinated, President Johnson took over, and your book, After Apollo, Richard Nixon and the American Space Program, tell us a little bit about Nixon's perspective on this. And first of all, he thought very highly, according to his aides, of the astronauts, correct? Apollo astronauts?
Oh, yeah. They were one journalist called them the sons he never had, even though they were only about 20 years younger than Nixon. I think it's worth mentioning Lyndon Johnson in this context. Johnson made sure that there was the money to finish Apollo, didn't hesitate to support the program after the Apollo 1 fire in January of 67, but would not provide a post-Apollo goal or make a major investment in post-Apollo programs. So when Nixon came in January of 69, it was clear that it was going to be his responsibility to make those decisions. And he made them, against a mixed background. He liked the idea of exploration. He said, a great nation explores the unknown. He said it over and over again. But he also said the next president has to balance the budget, and space is one of the areas that's going to have to be examined in terms of restricting funding. So he came in with a kind of mixed attitude, clearly saw Apollo 11 as a great opportunity to link some of his themes of being a peacemaker and of international cooperation. And he totally embraced and identified himself with the Apollo 11 mission, in the process never once mentioning John Kennedy.
I was going to ask you about that, the fact that the landing of the moon happened during his administration. That must have been a big feather in his cap, and especially without, as you said, mentioning JFK.
Right. There was a proposal coming from some of the former Kennedy aides to name the spacecraft, what ended up being Columbia, name it the John F. Kennedy. And, I mean, that got rejected out of hand in the Nixon White House.
I remember being rather surprised, even though I probably shouldn't have at the time, because it really wasn't that long between Apollo and the first shuttle mission. But I don't know that a lot of people realize that the shuttle technology dates back to the days of Apollo. It really is sort of very old school technology, and I'm thinking that's what made each mission just so astronomically expensive.
Well, the shuttle was supposed to be routine and supposed to be cheap. Those were the promises that NASA made, that its engineers could design a spaceship that could be routinely used at a cost that, in retrospect, seems almost laughably low, something like $7 to $10 million a flight, where got to inflate the dollars, but the shuttle ended up costing somewhere between $500 million to $1 billion a flight. There was a hubris in NASA, a sense that we got Americans to the moon, we can do anything. And I think there was kind of insufficient attention to the technical realities of what was being promised.
And also, I don't know if too many people realize that there were actually two other Apollo missions planned after Apollo 17, which was the last mission to the moon. But what exactly was the cause of those cancellations? Was it just the disinterest in the Apollo program at this time, or was it just to focus on the shuttle?
Well, there are a set of reasons. The people close to Apollo in NASA, people particularly in Houston, were aware of how risky it was and were happy that they achieved Kennedy's goal and were not too interested in trying to do it again and again and again. And they were operating under very severe budget constraints from the Nixon White House and wanted to get started on the new programs, particularly the shuttle. And so I think it was NASA rather than Richard Nixon and his associates that made the decision to cancel what had been Apollo 15 and Apollo 19. So one of the missions that was canceled was the last one without a rover, and then one of the last ones with a rover, and then they were renumbered. What had been 16 became 15. But yeah, there were two missions canceled.
And you also point out that there were actually plans to possibly even cancel Apollo 16 and 17 ahead of the election in 1972 because the fears of Apollo 13 were still fresh in Nixon's mind.
Yeah, Nixon was spooked by Apollo 13. He got very much involved in the fate of the astronauts. Henry Kissinger says he should have been worrying about invasions in Southeast Asia and Cambodia and Vietnam, but instead he was all of his emotional intensity was on the fate of Apollo 13. And he was almost in agreement with NASA. He said on tape, one of the advantages of doing something on Nixon from February 71 on is everything was on tape. And he said, I don't see any necessity of going back to the moon five or six more times. Let's cancel the last two. And we certainly don't want any repetition of the Apollo 13 accident before my reelection in November of 72.
We're visiting with Professor Dr. John M. Logsdon. He is the author of Richard Nixon and the American Space Program After Apollo. Again, Dr. Logsdon, the name of the book, After Apollo, Richard Nixon and the American Space Program. As you just mentioned about the Apollo 17, and he had his doubts about that, speaking of President Nixon, as they move on to the shuttle and designing that, there were some concerns there as well about national security, and especially if they were to do something with the Soviet Union.
Well, one of the drivers of the shuttle design was the idea that it could do some innovative national security missions. In particular, could be launched from the West Coast. And you have to remember, at that point, there was going to be two launch sites, one in Florida and one in California, go into a single orbit from California, either deploy or retrieve a spy satellite and come back down before Soviet Union knew it was there, and even go up, and if there were a suspicious satellite, and it would have to be in that period a Soviet satellite, and do an inspection and potentially even destroy or disable a hostile satellite. I mean, these were missions that were intriguing to Nixon and to some in the national security community, obviously never flown.
Now, what about, we're talking about the Soviet Union and the United States, and as Norma mentioned earlier, not just President Kennedy, but also Eisenhower, when Sputnik went up, everybody was concerned about the fact that the Russians were getting ahead of us. And working together with the Russians, correct me if I'm wrong, but astronaut Frank Borman met with some of the Russian officials about a joint program. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, tell us about that meeting and what are the concerns that perhaps Mr. Nixon had or some of his cabinet?
Well, Nixon, if you go back and read his inaugural address, January the 20th, 1969, he talked about cooperation in a wide variety of areas with the Soviet Union. He wanted to turn down the tensions and create an aura of detente rather than Cold War. And it was in that context that Borman went to Moscow after Apollo 8. He was the commander of Apollo 8. Had been invited by the Soviet ambassador Dobrynin to come and visit Moscow. He was the first astronaut to do that. And while he was there, he had conversations that were stimulated by Nixon's desire to find areas of cooperation with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was having trouble with its docking mechanisms. And so the idea of a joint U.S.-Soviet docking mission had its inception just in the weeks before Apollo 11. Took a couple of years to come to fruition. And I think most of the people, particularly Nixon and Kissinger, were very positive towards the idea of this fundamentally symbolic act.
I think there's a very famous picture, right, of the Apollo Soyuz mission of the two astronauts shaking hands after docking.
Right, right. This week is the 50th anniversary of the first spacewalk by one of those astronauts, Alexei Leonov, and there's been a lot of attention to Leonov and to the Apollo-Soyuz handshake in space, which was July of 1975, but had its origins with this Borman meeting, Nixon encouraging NASA to work with the Soviet Union to see whether there was grounds for cooperation, not on the shuttle, but on a mission very separate from that.
Now, as far as cooperation and President Nixon's choices of people, he wanted, very few people know about this, that he wanted Frank Borman to head up NASA. Was that not true?
There were a couple of times when one was right at the start of the Nixon administration. He had an acting administrator, a former deputy named Tom Paine. Several people were considered as a permanent administrator, and Borman, who had impressed Nixon upon first meeting after Apollo 8, was one of the candidates. And then when Paine left in September of 1970, disappointed because the White House would not approve his ambitious go-to-Mars post-Apollo plans, then once again Borman was a leading candidate for the job. Just as a sidebar, another candidate was a young Republican representative from Texas named George H.W. Bush.
I was noticing that Richard Nixon really made a very important mark on the space program from that point that seems to reverberate to this day. And you note that he makes three key decisions regarding the space program. One of them was keeping NASA as just simply an area of domestic policy. Another one was to end human spaceflight beyond low Earth orbit. And we really have not gone beyond Earth orbit since Apollo. And the other was to build the post-Apollo program around the space shuttle without any specific goals. So can you maybe elaborate on those three decisions that Nixon made?
Well, sure. I mean, he said in March of 1970 that the space program was no longer going to be treated especially in budget terms. It would have to compete with other domestic programs. And one of the things that's interesting in retrospect is while Kennedy saw space as an area of foreign policy and geopolitical competition, Nixon saw it as a domestic policy issue related to technology, to jobs, a bit American image, but it was not driven by his foreign policy values and objectives. So NASA would have to compete, and in that competition over the next 40 years, it hasn't done very well. It's down to one-half of 1% of the budget these days. By choosing the shuttle or by not setting another challenging goal like Moon, and the goal that he was offered was to plan for sending people to Mars in the 1980s, he in essence limited the program to low Earth orbit because the shuttle, which was the main program, that's as far as it could go. So there was no challenging or very specific goal except to open up space for routine access at an acceptable price. And it didn't turn out that that happened.
We're visiting with Professor Dr. John M. Logsdon. He is the author of the book, Richard Nixon and the American Space Program After Apollo. Professor John, in your book, and I'm trying to get this as far as if hopefully I got it right, what I interpreted in the book, when you write about the 1986 Challenger disaster, you said this could possibly be called a policy failure?
No, I'm saying that the shuttle. It was a policy failure, certainly in terms of, and I wrote an article right after Challenger
right. That
said the shuttle could be considered a policy failure. And it's important to understand that I'm not saying it was a technical failure. It was a remarkable technological achievement. But the policy that it was supposed to support, that is routine, relatively inexpensive access to space, it never could achieve. It was a failure in achieving the goals that it set out for it. I come to the conclusion in the book that there was a debate in the final months before the decision to build this particular shuttle design in November and December of 1971, that there were some alternatives offered that were not so much advanced in technology, not so large, not intended to do everything, that it might have been better to do an intermediate kind of vehicle, not quite as ambitious, as a learning experience before you built the full-size shuttle that we ultimately built. And so I think it was a mistake to approve the particular design for the shuttle that was approved, announced by President Nixon in January of 72.
And, speaking of the Challenger disasters, I think if everybody were to read up on the Apollo missions, it's really fascinating to know that pretty much anything that could go wrong with a mission seemed to go wrong. There were always these really scary glitches that happened on almost all the Apollo flights. I know one got struck by lightning after it left the launch pad. It's kind of a miracle that we were able to take these machines out into space. And I think it was Alan Shepard who said that, they're basically riding in a tin can on materials made from the lowest possible bidder. And I'm thinking that perhaps that was also something that might have been reflected in the shuttle, that each shuttle mission, I think everybody who goes into space, every astronaut knows there is risk involved, and yet they still want to be involved. They know that there's a possible disaster in the making, but they know that they do it because they want to further technology and they want to, I guess, reach out and somehow try to inspire something in others, despite the fact that maybe these missions may end in disaster?
Well, fortunately, not many missions have ended in disaster. I mean, during Apollo, NASA made it almost look too easy by extreme care in every detail, particularly after the Apollo 1 fire and the recognition that they had overlooked the consequences of a pure oxygen atmosphere on the launch pad. People that recovered Apollo after the Apollo 1 fire really were scrupulous in their attention to every detail. I think NASA lost some of that sharpness during the early years of the shuttle program. They were ignoring things that should not have been ignored. Challenger and, for that matter, Columbia were management failures, not technical failures. I think I was on the accident investigation board for Columbia, and we said that NASA had not given the care needed to operate the shuttle safely, which is a pretty strong indictment.
And I know a number of astronauts were also on those boards, I believe, that helped sort of determine what caused the Challenger accident and the negligence that sort of was involved in trying to get that mission into space.
Well, negligence is a pretty strong word, Norma. It was kind of not paying attention to warnings that should have been paid attention to.
So something that perhaps like when we get in our car and we're so used to doing things that we overlook things sometimes, not on purpose, we just are so used to doing things.
Well, I also think the Challenger mission, just because it was Krista McAuliffe, she was the first teacher in space, and there was so much media attention, I think maybe NASA might have been pressured to perhaps launch that mission.
There are people that make that argument, and let me come back in 3 or 4 years. My next project is President Reagan and space.
Okay. Yeah,
and that includes the launch of Challenger with Krista McAuliffe. You know, it's reputed that there was pressure because Reagan was going to mention it in the State of the Union speech. I have never seen any evidence. I'm going to look for it to see whether there's any sign that that is the case or not.
Well, John, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. We've been visiting with Professor Dr. John M. Logsdon. He has written the book Richard Nixon and the American Space Program After Apollo. He is also the author of John F. Kennedy and the Race to the Moon. So thank you very much for being with us here today.
Glad to be here.
Perspectives is taped and produced at KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and co-host Norma Martinez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sáenz.